Welcome to the Hereditary Transthyretin Amyloidosis edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the HATTR community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're talking today with Dr. John Burke, Director of the Clinical Trials for Familial Amyloidosis and the Localized Amyloid Clinic at Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Burke recently gave a webinar about clinical trials that was sponsored by the Boston-based Amyloidosis Research Consortium. And now we have the privilege of speaking to him face-to-face, so to speak. Thank you for being here.
Nice to meet you, and happy to discuss.
Please tell us, if you will, about amyloidosis in general and how you came to be an expert in this particular rare disease.
Oh, that's a mouthful right there. So I've been involved in the amyloid center, and particularly the amyloid clinic, over the past 25 years. And over the past approximately 18 years, I've been most interested in the development of therapeutics for TTR amyloid. And that was really the crux of the presentation that I recently gave for ARC.
Mm-hmm. How prevalent is the disease? How many people in the United States have it and around the world?
Well, pharmaceuticals dichotomize TTR amyloid into cardiomyopathy and polyneuropathy. And I think for the purposes of focusing FDA attention on the effectiveness of a drug, that's quite an effective portrayal of disease. The reality is that the vast majority of people have complete systemic involvement. And when you ask how many people are affected by the disease, there are sort of two major groups, and those that have polyneuropathy are thought to are difficult to really quantify, but are thought to affect in the United States probably around 3,500 people. But that's an estimate that far diminishes the real number. And I think that it's probably closer to 7,000 to maybe even as high as 10,000 people in the United States. Around the world, it's thought that people with polyneuropathy may number as many as 50,000. And again, I think that's an underestimate.
Right.
Cardiomyopathy is a different kettle of fish. And particularly the wild type form of TTR amyloid cardiomyopathy.
Much higher numbers, right?
Much higher numbers.
Right.
And, rare disease in the United States is defined as being less than 200,000 people afflicted.
Yes.
You know, if you do some calculations, there probably are more like 400,000 to 500,000 men age 80 and older who are walking around with amyloid cardiomyopathy. So it's effectively an unrecognized pandemic, and the same is true around the world, so it's not particular to Americans.
Now, I understand the hereditary form of amyloidosis dramatically disproportionately affects Black Americans compared to whites. Why is this, and how does it affect your ability to enroll minority patients in clinical trials?
That's actually a complex question. The simple answer is that 4% of the African American population and Afro-Caribbean population throughout the world carry a V122I mutation. The difficult part of that is trying to address the penetrance of that mutation, that is to say, how many people who have the mutation actually manifest clinical disease. And it's clearly less than 50% of those people, and probably closer to 25% that actually manifest clinical disease in their lifetime. The majority have cardiac involvement, but I think more and more we are recognizing that some V122I patients present with just neuropathy. Sometimes they'll have concomitant cardiomyopathy, but the neuropathy can be the primary effect.
And what about enrolling minorities in clinical trials?
Yeah, well, that too is somewhat complex. Right. You know, there's a long history, certainly in the United States, of mistreatment of African-American patients. And I think that legacy really carries over to today in terms of the distrust that many African-Americans have toward the research process. And so we work very hard to try and interest and involve people of color in clinical trials to mm-hmm. properly reflect what occurs in the real world. And as you point out, it appears that V122I, when it affects the heart, has a more aggressive course than, for instance, wild type TTR amyloid cardiomyopathy. So it's really an important issue.
You mentioned in the webinar that many of these people are reluctant to engage with you. I'm wondering, is there some biological reason why there should be this racial disparity for the disease?
Well, other than the prevalence of mutation, no. We see people who are Caucasian and have V122I, and they're subject to the same aggressive course of disease. So it's possible that there are epigenetic phenomena that accelerate the course of disease, but that's not something that has really been demonstrated to date.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is you set up to 400,000, maybe even 500,000 with the wild type, and if even only 25% of them have actual manifestation of the disease, that would make it more common than sickle cell, correct?
It would. So, you know, I think in the inner city cardiomyopathy clinics or congestive heart failure clinics, approximately 10% of that patient population will have V122I if there's careful genetics performed.
And yet we rarely hear about it, so I'm wondering why. Why do you think that is?
Cardiologists, I think, have been quite willing to embrace the challenge of identifying TTR amyloid cardiomyopathy. There, a significant proportion of the people of color will have associated diseases that make it a little more difficult to identify those that have infiltrative cardiomyopathy versus mm-hmm. hypertensive disease. So it takes a little bit of sophistication on the part of the cardiologists. You know, they've been trained to seek and treat hypertensive disease, and that's clearly very important. Many people in the investigative area of TTR disease are trying to encourage cardiologists to think a little more expansively mm-hmm. and to test the African-American population in particular, but really the whole heart failure population.
Right. Can we talk briefly about therapies and treatments? What do you see in general on the horizon? Are you hopeful that more treatments will come on the market in addition to what's already available?
Well, it's pretty remarkable the number that have been developed over the past 10 years. When you consider that, you know, the first therapeutic was liver transplantation back in 1990, and there was no interest or therapy for wild-type TTR cardiomyopathy, yet it dominates, you know, the space rather impressively. So the therapeutics, you know, go from pill-based to injectables or infusible agents. They address either stabilizing an unstable protein. Those are the oral agents, or suppressing the production of the abnormal protein with the injectables.
You mentioned in your webinar about Pfizer's trial of 441 patients. Wondering if you could just talk briefly about that.
The drug tafamidis had been shown to have some inhibitory effect in the course of polyneuropathy, and the FDA encouraged Pfizer to undertake a cardiomyopathy trial, and ultimately they did, and it's proved to be a real landmark event, resulting in the first FDA-approved agent for cardiomyopathy, ATTR cardiomyopathy. I think it's important to realize that the drug affects preservation of walking ability, quality of life, all-cause mortality, the frequency of cardiovascular hospitalizations. But in all those instances, even in the treated population, there is still progressive disease. So the unmet need remains, and that is really the challenge for TTR gene silencers, which are in development.
I just wanted to mention, of course, this week marks the 40th anniversary of the Orphan Drug Act, which, of course, provided incentives for manufacturers to develop therapies for hundreds of diseases that up until that point had no treatment, or let alone a cure. I'm wondering, just in closing, your final thoughts on how you see development, let's say, in the next 5 or 10 years for amyloidosis.
Well, we're on the verge of seeing the potential impact of gene editing, and obviously there's a huge amount of excitement about that. I think there are some additional things we have to learn about the importance of TTR. And beyond gene editing is addressing a future unmet need, and that's going to be brain involvement by ATTR amyloid, because there is a separate factory in the choroid plexus for that, and none of the therapies at the moment reach that factory.
Dr. Burke, thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.